News Talk 580 WTCM, 8 minutes after 10 o'clock. It's Wednesday, November the 14th, and our very good friend Bonnie Pintozzi joining us from the Travel Authority, an L-Tour company. Bonnie, it's so great to see you.
Oh, it's great to be back, and it's exciting, and what a guest we have today.
Can I just say, I am incredibly excited to hear about these particular journeys that are so tailor-made for everything that I've ever wanted to do. I'm looking at this website going, I want to go there. I want to go there.
I've always wanted to go there because this particular company, Abercrombie & Kent, has been in the travel industry for so many years. And it's always been this hallmark of distinction, the quality, the adventures, the everything that they do. So I'm not going to mention that. I'm going to let Bob Simpson do all that. He's vice president of Expedition Cruising. And Bob is here today to just tell us and take us away. So, Bob, good morning, and just start taking us away and tell us a little bit more about the background of Abercrombie & Kent.
Well, good morning. Good morning. Very pleased to be with you guys this morning. Boy, what a great introduction. it has been quite a journey for us as a company, not just with what I do with Expedition Cruising, but as you know, Bonnie, and our friends are aware that A&K has been around for a very, very long time, since 1962. Company founded by Jeffrey Kent, who is still our chairman today and very, very much still involved in our business. Matter of fact, I'm going to see him here shortly after this interview. He's in our office for some meetings. The company's been well established for a long time. And what I'm here to talk about today is our Expedition Cruise product, which is something that I oversee here at A&K. I've done that for quite a number of years. I first started at A&K in 1998, so going on 21 years that I've been involved with our Expedition Cruise product. As a company, we've operated Expedition Cruises for just over, actually, 28 years. Matter of fact, 2020 is going to be quite a special year, a couple of celebrations. One, and I'll start with our product with Antarctica. 2020 is sort of recognized as the bicentennial year of the discovery of the continent. A number of expeditions in 1820 that are sort of credited with the discovery of the Antarctic continent. There was an American expedition led by Nathaniel Palmer. Some of you may recognize the name Palmer. It's sort of our namesake for the U.S. Antarctic program. The research station down in the Antarctic Peninsula, named after Palmer, a Russian Admiral Bellinghausen, and then also a British commander, Richard Bransfield, all sort of in that year, have credit in some way of finding the continent of Antarctica. And in 2020, it will be A&K's 30th year. So wow. 30 of those 200 years that we've been doing this. So we've been doing it for a long time. We're one of the longest operating companies in the Antarctic, as a matter of fact. And so it's something that's really been sort of a core DNA product for the company. Go ahead.
Bob, I know that after 30 years and having been a leader in this for so long, you know what you need with your ships, especially how they're strategically chartered vessels. They're the right ships for the right places. So when you start, and I'm going to ask you to start talking about the polar regions and all the things that are going on, it's the fact that, you know how to do it right, and you have always done that well.
Yeah, and our history, actually, we used to own and operate our own ship, the old Explorer, the little red ship. It's kind of the ship started this whole business, really. We sold it a little over 15 years ago, and at that time, the company, A&K, we made a really strategic decision that, we didn't want to be tied in with specific hardware is sort of the easiest way to explain it. And, there's a lot of different places that we sort of have our core expertise and competency, but we always also want to be able to be nimble enough to be on the right ships, as you as you pointed out, the right ships in the right places. And so, what we do is you know, I talk about hardware being the ship. The software is sort of the intangible. That's our expedition team. The experience that we have you know, curated over, you know, like we say, those 30 years, nearly 30 years, that we're able to take and put into the platforms that we use for the discovery of the program. So for Antarctica, we charter a ship called the Le Lyrial. It's a ship owned by the French cruise company Panant. We have a great working relationship with them, as a matter of fact. Most of our programs actually are involved on Panant vessels. But the relationship's such a good one because what they provide us is that platform. So when we charter the ship, it's really the environment of which we put our product on. So we put our expedition team, our expertise, our enrichment program onto the ships that we then operate the program. So whether it's in the Antarctic, as we're talking about, and we're actually about a month away. Yesterday was 1 month until our beginning of our season, actually, in December. And then also, you know, the up north in the Arctic regions as well. Same concepts in terms of how we operate, just sort of in different polar regions.
Wow.
And Bob, one of the things I'm sure the selection process of your staff, your team members, is pretty extensive because you know that that is the hallmark of what you've all done. And like you said, Jeffrey Ken is still involved. And when you still have your name on the company, you take that pride in quality. And that's what we have always found at A&K's hallmark is that, you know, your product, your team are comprehensive and very experienced. And you're talking specifically on the expedition side, but obviously there's a great variety of other types of trips that A&K does as well. So
that's right. And
go ahead.
And that's exactly right. And you know, Jeffrey Kent has often said that you know, his vision with his company actually was he wanted to create a level of consistency. So no matter where our travelers are going, whether it's to Beijing or Buenos Aires or Cairo, that when they arrive, that the person that is there to meet them and lead them effectively is the same person. So obviously not the same individual, but the qualities, the experience, the attributes that we expect for those that we entrust our guests to on the ground are all very, very consistent and common. And so with our expedition team, that's you know, probably the largest element of my job is to make sure that we're building these very consistent, experienced teams on board, because at the end of the day, we're sending our travelers to places that are very, very remote, right? And so we have to make sure that we have the right people on the ground and operating the programs. So a lot of our team, you know, in terms of how we put these teams together, it's also very important. We need to make sure that, you know, every program is a little bit different in terms of whether it's the focus of the enrichment program or elements of you know, interest that we're trying to draw out within the program, whether it's history or, you know, marine mammals certainly is a big, you know, all these different elements of enrichment, that we make sure that we have the right individuals in those positions. And many of these folks are actually like family for me. I've worked with, you know, as long as I've been here, literally. So a lot of our team, our consistent core expedition team, have been working with A&K consistently year after year, going back to the old Explorer days. So well over 20, 25, you know, many years. Our expedition director, for example, Susana Machado de Oliveira, has worked nearly every program that we've operated over the last 15 years. So when our guests travel, whether they go to the Antarctic and then they come back with us and they're up in the Arctic or they're in, you know, on some of our other programs, most of the faces that they see when they get on board are the same faces that they've traveled with already. So it's a great feeling of you know, confidence, obviously, but also this camaraderie, and they really develop a loyal sort of following as well. And so we were talking about the polar regions, of course, is sort of what we're best known for, I think, in terms of our, you know, small ship and expedition cruising. But, you know, increasingly, actually, and for many years, we've been operating programs outside of the polar regions in some of these very cultural and, you know, sort of focused types of itineraries, whether it's, you know, Japan or that we've been doing actually for nearly a decade. Greece, we just operated a brand new Greece itinerary. These types of places that actually are inherently ideal for doing by small ship, because you're able to cover sort of a very wide area of geography, but also to be able to do it in a very comprehensive way as well.
I want to talk about the small ships for a second, Bob, because I'm looking at some of these cruises and you know, these are luxury group cruises, but you don't take more than maybe 150, sometimes more than 199 guests on these journeys. And just that intimacy, I mean, you have to walk away. If you go to Antarctica with a group of, you know, 200 people, they have to become your 200 best friends, because there's no other experience like that.
Right. And, you know, you raise a really good point, and you know, this is actually, it goes to the heart of sort of the philosophy of how we operate our programs as well. We have very specific, tangible metrics that we use in terms of the number of passengers that we want to have on a program for various reasons. And a lot of times, irregardless of the capacity of the ship itself. So, just for example, the L'Oréal that we charter up in the Antarctic, the ship can carry 246 passengers. So if we fill the ship at full capacity, you can put 246 passengers on board the ship, and that's what the ship is designed to carry. We limit our capacity in the Antarctic at no more than 199 passengers. And why do we do that? There's a couple of reasons. One is that in the Antarctic, there are operating sort of restrictions in terms of passenger numbers, and this is set by an organization that we happen to be a longtime member, IATO, which is the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators. And what IATO is the representative sort of, the voice of tourism relative to what happens in the Antarctic. There are three primary activities that occur in the Antarctic. One is science and research, and that's all sort of under the umbrella of national science and Antarctic programs. The other is fishing and fisheries. And then the third is tourism. There's an entity that's known as the Antarctic Treaty, and it's actually been in place for over 50 years. The Antarctic Treaty basically sets sort of parameters and guidelines in terms of human activity in Antarctic, because don't forget, Antarctica is a continent, but it is not a country. There's no sovereign control over the continent of the Antarctic. So the Antarctic Treaty was put in place in order to maintain a level of oversight and control and protection of this amazing environment, right? And so IATO is the sort of umbrella over what happens within tourism. And so part of the Antarctic Treaty rules state that you cannot put more than 100 passengers ashore at any one time.
Wow.
Okay? And then one of the other regulations is in terms of access to land passengers on shore. And so there's different categories of operation. Category one, which is what we are ships that carry under 200 passengers. Okay? Category two are ships that carry 200 to 500 passengers. And then there's a third category, which are cruise only. And that's there are Princess Cruises and Holland America. A number of our, you know, friends at the cruise companies actually do send ships down to the Antarctic, but they do a cruise by. So they are not permitted to actually land passengers ashore, but they cruise along the peninsula and people get a chance to see it. And it's a great experience, but they're not able to land people ashore. Mm-hmm. Category two ships, those are the 200 to 500, they are able to land people ashore, but they're only able to access about 30% of the recognized and approved landing sites, right? Category one operators can go to any sites that are approved and recognized as landing sites within the Antarctic Peninsula. So we choose for the sake of our operation, we don't want to limit the experience for our guests. So we make sure we do not put more than 200 passengers on the ship. And because we've done it that way for so long, we've kind of extended that to all of our expedition and polar operations, whether it's in Svalbard or the Arctic or certainly within Antarctica. What else does that do? It also creates an environment on board the ship that is of a much higher level of comfort, to be honest, and also service level, right? Mm-hmm. So we have 200 passengers on a ship that's designed to carry 246. We don't bring any crew off. So the crew that are on board is the same crew that's on board to service up to 246 guests. So we have about roughly 70 to 75% of the design ship's occupancy with the same higher number of crew. So the level of service actually enhances and improves as well. So that's sort of a byproduct of the fact that we limit the numbers. But the core reason is really for the sake of our operation to make sure that we are able to deliver sort of the expedition experience that we've done for so many years that's very, very important to us.
Well, and so, Bob, is a point of difference. It's a true point of difference because, I'm listening to you and there's some things I just learned today as well as you were going through that. And I think that when someone looks at the various cruise lines and they go, okay, well, I want to do this or whatever be the case, they may not really comprehend that they might just be cruising by or they might be limited to where it is. This is a true point of difference because you are putting all these factors in place.
And, I think it's so interesting because Antarctica is on so many bucket lists right now. So many people say, yes, I want to go there because the way that people are traveling is really changing. They want to get to places that nobody would ever think of, as being, and they're getting there with Abercrombie and Kent. But what is the best time of year to go to Antarctica? I mean, I think about this and I go, is there ever a better time than others?
Well, I think that it sort of depends on sort of what the interest level is, but by and large, the best time of the year to go is sort of right in the height of the austral summer, which is sort of December and January. And there's a couple of elements to that. One is that generally speaking, I say generally speaking because you never can control when it comes to weather and conditions and things like that, ice prevalence and things like that. But at the end, historically, that time period of the year, generally speaking, is more sort of tranquil in terms of the weather conditions. So just from a standpoint of temperature and general likelihood of the low pressure systems and storms and things like that that do create an issue in terms of our programs, are generally less prevalent during that time. The other thing is, think about Antarctica again. It's this land mass that's completely surrounded by water. It's really the only continent that fits that description. And so you have forever since the beginning of since the continents drifted and separated, I suppose, that you've got this circular kind of current that goes around the continent. It's called the circumpolar current. And so it creates its own sort of weather and systems. It becomes a little bit more because when the water temperatures slightly rise a little bit more and the conditions actually improve to where you don't have as much heavy weather systems and things like that generally during the height of the summer, which is, again, the austral summer. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that you have because of the nature of the continent itself, the seasonality of things change so much different than they do really for us, say, here in North America, where you have accelerated sort of seasonal types of changes in activity. And that has an impact also on a lot of the wildlife in terms of, and particularly the penguins. At the end of the day,
I just want to see the baby penguins.
You want to see the baby penguins.
the big thing that really everybody wants is the penguins, right?
Yeah.
And you see them by the thousands and thousands.
Oh, wow.
But you do have a different level of experience. And we talked about the chicks, right? And so you do want to go, you don't want to go too early because they're, say in November, because the chicks haven't, in most of the rookeries, they haven't actually hatched. You have a lot of But there again, it's kind of a cool because you have a little bit more of this sort of maternal activity. Mm. You've got the, you know, the parents that are still, you know, incubating the eggs and they're sitting on the nest. And so you've got that sort of kind of element. But you don't have as much of the chick activity yet because they haven't hatched yet. So when you get into December, then you start getting the chicks are hatching, and the activity level in the rookeries itself is greatly enhanced because you've got a lot of bustling activity with, you know, feeding and things like that. Then when you get later into the end of the summer, right, which is going into February, and then mm-hmm. into March, which starts sort of going into the autumn, you actually start losing the populations because most of the species, there's only two species that will remain basically in their environments. That's the Adelie penguins and that's the emperor penguins, which mm-hmm. are much further into the continent, actually, don't migrate as much. But the majority of the penguins' populations there actually go to sea, right? And so when you start getting into the late summer, the nests are all emptying out, and then towards the end of February, you almost have no penguins in some of these places. So
good to know, Bob, because no February, definitely.
So no yeah. February. If you want to see a bunch of, especially the
well,
the,
you could
the,
see whales, maybe.
You can, and actually, yeah. That's a really good point. You know, and historically, February was always sort of a better time for whale watching. But actually, I was just having a conversation with one of our team yesterday that so much has changed with the elements of climate that, mm-hmm. that actually whale activity in the Antarctic is much, much more like sort of season long now. We're seeing sort of the same activity in whales in early and mid December that we used to not see as much until much later in the season, and we're seeing it a lot earlier, which actually brings me to another really interesting thing, I think, is in that for a lot of our programs that we operate with, not just the Antarctic, but certainly up in the Arctic regions as well, how much has changed over the years, even for us, in terms of climate, how climate's changed, right. And how it's changed, you know, not just how we operate, but obviously, and you see stories. It's not anything new in terms of populations of the penguins and even the polar bears, obviously, up north. And a lot of that is because of how every element of the biological chain, the food chain, has mm-hmm. changed, right? Because it all goes down to the lowest common denominator. And in most instances, that goes down to the krill and the small little sea creatures that feed the chain all the way up, right, to the mm-hmm. to the penguins, to the seals, to the whales, and then obviously up to the mammals when we're up in the Arctic. And so much of that has changed as well over the years that is very compelling, and it's real. You know, it's something that we're dealing with every year. We deal with it in a different way.
Well, Bob Simpson, I definitely have wanderlust right now. This
definitely.
Incredible desire to travel. And Bonnie, what's the best way that people can make this
honestly,
happen?
Honestly, we have been working with ANK for years. We're very versed on their product. Just give us a call, the Travel Authority and Altour Company. We can get those dreams. And Bob, you just described something
I learned so much.
So amazing. And I'd love to go on and on, but unfortunately, we're out of time right now.
That happens to me all the time.
I'm sure it does. But we can take the time with anyone listening to the show or telling friends about it. Just come in and we'll talk about it and see if this is something that'll work for you, because ANK is definitely a product that's incredible.
This is one of those things that doesn't have to be once in a lifetime.
No.
There are many definitions or destinations rather
absolutely.
That you can get to. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Bob
Simpson.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much, guys.
You bet.
Oh, once I can see.